Okay, Nehemiah. Very exciting. So this being the first year we'll do on Nehemiah, so we'll do a little bit of background into what we see in Nehemiah's character sort of in the background. We'll see more, obviously, as we learn about what he does and how he works his way through the world, through the stories in our Sefer. We'll also do a little bit of background into Nehemiah as distinct from Ezra, meaning as a Sefer. We call it Ezra Nehemiah, so that's a little bit unusual, and we're going to continue calling it Nehemiah. So there, it's one really interesting observation about that. And we'll try to do Parak Aleph, which we'll see how much of Parak Aleph we're able to do. It's only 11 psukim, so it should be fairly possible to get through the Parak today as well, and kind of see his first initiatives, we'll call them. And we'll see exactly how those develop over the course of the Sefer. So just first of all, in terms of who Nehemiah is, right? So we've heard about him. He's, partners with Ezra. And already we probably have a bit of an impression. I've been, alluding to this kind of theory about Ezra and Nehemiah for a little while, though it's going to get more complicated now that we meet Nehemiah, is that Ezra and Nehemiah kind of represent two different patterns or models of leadership. Ezra being more of a religious leader, he's a Kohen, he's a Torah authority, he's a little bit less, politically engaged and politically active. And Nehemiah, who's much more of a statesman, of a politician, who's really able to use initiatives and start getting things done. A great formulation of this idea is found in the Gemara in Masechet Gittin. And source number one, the Gemara says that from the days of Moshe until Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Lo matzinu Torah u'gdula b'makom echad. We have not found that Torah greatness and gedula, which literally means greatness, but seems to refer to secular or political kinds of authority, have been in one place. Right? So Moshe had that. And Moshe was the leader who brought us out of Egypt. He was also the Notan HaTorah. And then since then, you don't have other examples of that to the same extent. Then the Gemara goes on to say, but we have tons of examples of that. Yehoshua is an example of that. David's an example of that. But each and every time, the Gemara tries to show how really, there were other people who also possessed certain kinds of authority simultaneously. So at the time when Moshe was the sole, singular, peak authority in both of these realms, well, that's very unusual, right? So Yeshua's, both political authority and religious authority, but not in the same exclusive way, where he has both of them to their maximal degree. So one example of that, the Gemara says, is Ezra. Ezra is both a Torah leader, we've talked about that extensively, and he's a political leader. He's the one who leads the people, he leads the efforts against intermarriage, etc. So that seems to be a good example. Says the Gemara, no, Hava Nehemiah ben Chachalia. At the same time as Ezra, there was also Nehemiah, and Nehemiah was the one who bore political authority. And so Ezra is not an example of someone who had, full, total, unambiguous religious and political authority. So if you want, that Gemara to kind of be the slogan of the whole Sefer Ezra Nehemiah, you definitely could try to make that argument that Ezra's a religious leader, he has political responsibilities, and Nehemiah is a political leader, and that's his primary role. We'll see as we go on, even in our parak today, that picture is a little bit overly simplified, that Nehemiah is not just a political leader, but he's someone who also has some religious strength behind him, and of course we saw that Ezra also has various kinds of political authority. So what do we know about Nehemiah before we reach our Sefer, or based on the Masoros we have from Chazal about Nehemiah? So a couple of interesting kinds of observations. And some of them are foreshadowing for things we'll see later, some of them are pieces of background. Number one is Yichus. We're told Nehemiah, we'll see in the first pasuk of the Sefer, Nehemiah is the son of Chachalia. Of course, we all know who Chachalia is. No, none of us know who Chachalia is. No one knows. And the commentaries don't know. He's not mentioned elsewhere, as far as I know, anywhere in Tanakh, but certainly not in the lists in Ezra. So I have no idea who Chachalia is. Right? If you remember, and we'll make the comparison more thoroughly in a little bit, right? Ezra has a really strong yichus. It goes all the way back to Aaron. Nehemiah, he's the son of Chachalia. We don't know who Chachalia is. The Gemara tries to account for that gap and say, no, actually, Nehemiah is really a very significant person. He identifies Nehemiah with Zerubbabel. The Gemara, based on a passage in Dibra Hayamim, that seems to mention these three different names of the Gemara identifies as the same person. So the Gemara says, in source number two, in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Shaltiel was one of his names, Shenishal al Alato. Right? So he's a Yechoniah, was in, was in exile. This is one of the last and the exile kings of Yehudah from Bayit Rishon. And he's sort of given permission, so to speak, to have further descendants. So he's called Shaltiel because he had to be Nish'al al Alato. He had an oath, and then you know, he had to retract that oath. He's called Zerubbabel, Shenizra b'Bavel. He was born in Bavel. We talked about Zerubbabel back in the earlier Prakim of Ezra. Umashmo, Nehemiah ben Chachalia shmo. So Nehemiah is identified as Zerubbabel, who's a descendant of the Davidic lineage. So don't think that Nehemiah is some backwater nobody. We'll see he also has a very significant role in the king's court very shortly. But even just in terms of his background and his yichus, he's a Davidic figure, according to Chazal. We're trying to account for his, you know, seeming lack of qualifications, let's say, or yichus, to fill in some of the picture here. And we'll see that Nehemiah carries himself with a certain authority, as we mentioned, in terms of his relationship to both the Jews and to the secular authorities, the Persian authorities. He also has to deal with a lot of adversity in his work. We'll see that more as foreshadowing for the upcoming Prakim. But this really should be a Rashi. I made a mistake in source number 3. It's not a Gemara, it's a Rashi on Sanhedrin. But the Gemara there is has this thesis that if you have enemies in this world, it also means God's mad at you, right? You basically have, enemies. You have enemies below, you have enemies above, so to speak. And then the Gemara brings some exceptions to that rule. It tries to infer from a pasuk in Iyov, it's a little bit complicated. But for our purposes, what matters is the Gemara brings an exception. And the exception the Gemara cites, it's two exceptions. I think one of them is David HaMelech, who has enemies below, Avshalom and Shaul and Yoam, whoever else is an enemy in Sefer Shmuel. And Nehemiah, who also has lots of enemies. Rashi there says that he has foreign enemies, Shayelusonim Harbemi Nachrim Shemavakshim Lahargo. He's going to be involved in further strengthening the Beit HaMikdash. And he has enemies who oppose him for that. And Hayulo Kana'im Yisrael. He had internal enemies among the Jewish people, Shayim Mavazanotu, who would disgrace him, who would denigrate him. And so Nehemiah is someone who is going to be standing up against a lot of pressure. Right? I don't think you would have said that Ezra per se has enemies. Ezra has some other Jews who aren't as excited about stopping intermarriage. But Ezra doesn't really have enemies. The idea here that Nehemiah has enemies is a very interesting kind of notion, that he's really dealing with a lot more opposition. And that might be reflected in various ways throughout the writing of Sefer Nehemiah. One way in which that might be manifest is in some of Nehemiah's tefillahs, where he almost prays that he should be remembered for the good, Zachur Latov. This is a passage from the Encyclopedia Mikra'it. Efshar shechiburo no'ad l'shamish k'tav magen neged oivav harabim. It's possible that writing Sefer Nehemiah, we'll talk about whether Nehemiah really wrote Nehemiah anyway in just a second, but it's meant to be sort of a defense against his enemies. Umikan tefilato harigila b'chibur zeh, shehashem yizkor lo l'tovat ma'asav hatovim. He wants to do good things and develop a good legacy for the good that he does. That's his tefillah. That's what he wants from Hashem, because he knows that he has enemies who are pushing back against them and are trying to tarnish his legacy or destroy his legacy. So he wants his work to be successful, and he wants as well that lo yivav yizkor l'ra'ad ma'aseim harayim, that everyone should know, what really happened. Everyone should know that he's really the good guy and his enemies are really the bad guys. This observation comes from the fact, at least in part, that a lot of Sefer Nehemiah has written autobiographically in the first person. We noticed that a little bit in Ezra, but only in the last couple of prakim, and even then it kind of ping-ponged a little bit back and forth, more of Nehemiah is going to reflect this first-person kind of perspective. So you get the sense you're really reading almost like a memoir or a diary. It's clearly meant for public consumption, so it's probably more like a memoir or an autobiography of Nehemiah. So that's a couple of pieces already in terms of his yichus, in terms of his relationship to foreign authorities. What about his personality? So we don't know a ton in the background. There's one piece that Chazal say, and we'll see whether it, again, holds up so well over the course of Sefer Nehemiah as we, meet the character and see how he presents himself. But the Gemara actually criticizes Nehemiah for certain kinds of, we'll call it arrogance, probably is the right term. Right, so we'll take a look at this Gemara in full, because it will also reflect on some of the other questions about Nehemiah, like whether he wrote his own Sefer or not. All of the matters of Ezra were said by Nehemiah. it's not 100% clear that whether this is referring only to the second part of Ezra Nehemiah, just the Nehemiah part, or whether Nehemiah even wrote the first part of Ezra Nehemiah. We've been assuming Ezra wrote it, but this Gemara maybe sounds like Nehemiah wrote the whole thing. Well, if that's true, says the Gemara, then Nehemiah ben Chachalia, my time alo ikri sifra al shmei. Why isn't it named after him? You could have called the book Nehemiah or Nehemiah Ezra instead of Ezra Nehemiah. That would be very strange to be Nehemiah Ezra. Probably just Sefer Nehemiah if he wrote it, right? The same way Shmuel wrote Sefer Shmuel and Yoshua wrote Sefer Yoshua. For many Sfarim, we named them after their authors. Should have done the same here. And the Gemara says it was a punishment. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba, Mimeshe Hechzik Tova La'atmo. He took credit for himself. He spoke arrogantly. Right? We saw earlier the Encyclopedia Mikra Eats was trying to claim this is part of his sort of public defense, explaining how he did the right thing. But the Gemara here seems to be a little bit critical of that. Zachrali Elokai Latova. Right? Nehemiah says, Hashem should remember me for good. Right? I obviously earned all the good that I did. It's all by merit. And that's a kind of arrogance that means we don't write a sefer and name it after you. Was that really such a bad thing? Didn't David do the same thing? Zachrini Hashem b'ritzon amcha? No, because David was just davening. Right? When David said, I did great things, or remember me for all the good that I did, that's a tshila, that's a request. When Nehemiah did it, that was quid pro quo. You know, haven't I done good enough? You know, you really owe me, God. And that's a kind of spiritual, overconfidence, shall we say, that maybe is not necessarily so appropriate. And then on a similar theme, the Gemara brings another possibility, which also reflects a certain kind of, you know, overconfidence or self-centeredness. Rav Yosef Amar, Mibnesha Siper, Bignutan Shal Rishonim. He spoke badly of earlier generations. We'll see, these are both references to Nehemiah Perek Hei, so we'll see that in a couple of weeks. But apparently Nehemiah's formulations were a little bit too self-congratulatory and a little bit too critical of previous generations. Right? We have a halachic principle about avoiding being motzi la'az ala rishonim. Right? Don't, you know, do things in halacha that make it look like previous generations weren't as from, and that you think you're better than the generations that came before. So this is another kind of manifestation of that idea, that positive reflection on earlier generations. And we'll, you know, not get into the weeds of this particular detail, but he talks about who exactly he denigrated. It was Daniel, so Daniel's not a contemporary of Nehemiah, but someone in the same world of, you know, Galus and Bayashani kind of world. So the Gemara takes a pretty critical stance on Nehemiah's confidence and Nehemiah's overconfidence. Rav Dov Zakheim, this is actually a great book to be aware of for learning Sefer Nehemiah in particular. It's part of the Magid series of studies in Tanakh. There are these sort of mostly thinner white volumes published by Magid, by Koren. And they have them for many Sfarim in Tanakh, including on Sefer Nehemiah. This is written by Dov Zakheim, who was a diplomat in the U.S. government. And he wrote about Nehemiah, who the book is called Nehemiah, Statesman and Sage. He saw Nehemiah sort of as a model for himself, as also a statesman in a foreign government. So he has a lot to say that's quite interesting about Nehemiah from that perspective. And he also makes note of the fact that Nehemiah, unlike Ezra, who really lets other people take charge and lead, Nehemiah takes initiatives on his own and doesn't even consult with anyone for advice on any of his initiatives, which also he thinks of as reflective of a certain kind of confidence. And he notes later on in that passage that the sages criticize Nehemiah for that kind of confidence, but it also may just, you know, figuring out how morally to take it and whether it's, you know, worthy of criticism or not is something that, you know, reasonable people can try to debate. The Gemara is more critical. Other commentaries maybe don't need to be, as long as you see that Nehemiah is just a politician who's presenting himself in a certain kind of way. So that's, I think, a major point about Nehemiah's personality that should be noted. Now, we'll see that it's not exactly as clear earlier in Sefer Nehemiah, but it might be something that develops over the course of the Sefer. We'll have to see whether that really holds up. But one, you know, great final note just about this background to Nehemiah, which already, you know, will be mashpia a little bit in terms of the question of writing or the name of the Sefer. I have to give credit to Rabbi Torchino for finding this. I never find these Chomot Anachs without him. That's the Chidah, one of the early Achronim, very incredibly prolific writer. And he notes, well, originally, right, Ezra Nehemiah was one sefer, and it was just called Ezra. And the Gemara refers to it as Ezra and doesn't seem to be sensitive to a distinction between the two books at all. And it's something that seems to be really of Christian origin, and then something that we eventually kind of inculcated and borrowed back in our own practical purposes. And the Chidah in source number 7 says that's not a coincidence, because the reason that the book of Nehemiah wasn't named after Nehemiah was because of these sins that Nehemiah did. Well, after Lomar Demasha Amar Zachroli Alokalatova Onema Inami Bmasha Zibra Bagnutin Shal Rishon, whatever sin you attribute to him, Barov Hayamim Nitkaper, he's gotten kapara. Right? It's been, you know, let's say from Nehemiah's life in the I think the 5th century BCE until the late Middle Ages, at least. There's almost 2,000 years. Over the course of almost 2,000 years, Nehemiah got kapara for whatever, you know, alleged character flaws there were. And therefore, we could now start calling Sefer Nehemiah as opposed to Ezra. And he says it's not a coincidence, it's rather hashkacha. Einu mikra hashvashalom. It's not coincidental. Raka kol bedikduk gamor. It's very precise. It's Hashem kind of running the world. So Hashem, at some point, Nehemiah, you know, got kapara after his death, and well, at that point, we're able to really call the Sefer Nehemiah. So, for our purposes, we'll be calling Nehemiah, you know, Nehemiah, Perek, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, etc. And that's, you know, common nomenclature, you know, as people practically kind of use the terminology. Maybe that's just coincidence. We borrowed, you know, Christian divisions, the same way we borrowed Christian chapter divisions, where every chapter, you know, begins and ends. But the Chidah says, no, it's really not a coincidence at all, and we're actually meant to see this as a little bit more kind of meaningful, as reflective of the tshuva process for Nehemiah. Really interesting. Just a good note to have in your back pocket when you think about the name of the Sefer. Okay, so that's by way of introduction, right? We know a little bit about his personality, some of the things that he's going to face over the course of his career, a little bit about his origins and background as a maybe, you know, Davidic kind of king. I should note, by the way, that the identification of Zerubbabel with Nehemiah only works according to certain chronologies. We're not going to, you know, go back into that minefield, but we should know that according to our chronology of the Sefer, the one that you know, the Dat Mikra and others use, that the book is mostly in chronological order. So we have one aliyah from Zerubbabel with Koresh, then Ezra comes a little bit later, and then Nehemiah comes roughly contemporary with Ezra, but also seemingly about 10-15 years later. So you wouldn't be able to say that Nehemiah and Zerubbabel are the same person, because they would have lived generations apart. But according to more traditional chronology, so that becomes a little bit more plausible, because they're really all coming around this, you know, beginning of Bayit Sheni, like reconstructing the Mikdash period. So we're not going to get back into all the weeds of that, but even if you don't want to take the chronology, just the idea of identifying Nehemiah with a longer legacy of Jewish leadership is something that's fairly significant. You can see what the Gemara is trying to do there.
What's the time difference between Ezra and Nehemiah?
So it's very unclear. There's a lot of scholarly debate about this, right? Both in traditional sources, they're... Well, take a step back. They must be at least somewhat contemporaneous, because we'll get to Parak Chet of Nehemiah, and they're around at the same time. Mm-hmm. So they're overlapping and they're working in the same period. So that said, there's still controversy about whether Nehemiah came first and then Ezra came first, then Nehemiah, whether Nehemiah came to Israel, left, and came back, which doesn't seem to be, you know, the simple pshat, but could be reflected there. I think the way I learned about this when I was, took like an early Jewish history class, I think, in college, and I think this mostly reflects contemporary consensus, is that Nehemiah postdates Ezra by something like 15 years. So he's, you know, Ezra's there, he's running things, he's trying to get rid of, you know, intermarriage, but you know, not doing so well. Then Nehemiah's going to come and he's really going to, you know, hammer that home and address some of those problems. We'll see more also about the context and the time as we start reading Sefer Nehemiah. So let's jump into that. So Nehemiah begins. Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia. Right? There are many books in Tanakh, by the way, that begin, you know, the words of Nehemiah ben Chachalia, or the words of X Navi or Y Navi, which also gives you this impression that maybe we're, you know, seeing a new unit in the Sefer. Right? Even if you didn't have the Ezra and Nehemiah division, you would know that you're dealing with something different than what came before. Right? This is clearly a different Sefer. The words of Nehemiah ben Chachalia. Vayi v'chodesh Kislev. This is one of the later books in Tanakh. So we have the Babylonian names of the months. Right? It's Kislev. It's not Chodesh HaChi'i anymore. Esther is another example. Right? In Esther, we call the 12th month the month of Adar, Sivan, etc. So it's in the month of Kislev, in Shnat Esrim, the 28th year, presumably the 28th year of Artaxasta. According to our timeline, that works very well. Ezra comes in year, I think, 6 of Artaxasta, so Nehemiah is coming in year 20. Vani Haiti Bishushan Habira. You can't ignore the parallels, right? They're clearly living in the same context, where you have the palace in Shushan. And there are whole discussions about if Shushan Habira is distinct from Shushan, whether it refers to like the castle or the fortress within the city of Shushan, or if it refers to a different location. So there's interesting discussions to have there. That's more of a Megillah Esther topic. Vayavochanani, so we'll read the story and then kind of fill in with any questions that we might have. There are, you know, a number of questions we can ask about just these couple of psukim. Vayavochanani, Hanani came, echad me'achai, one of my brothers, hu v'anashim Yehuda, with the others who came from Yehuda. V'ashalem al Yehudim ha'pleita asher nesharu min ha'shvi v'al Yerushalayim. And I asked them about the remaining Jews who remained from captivity and about Yerushalayim. Read the next pasuk and then we'll ask our questions about these psukim. Vayomruli hanisharim asher nisharu. Vayomruli, sorry, they said to me, hanisharim asher nisharu min hashvi sham b'medina, those who remained from the captivity in that province, biragdola, they're in a bad place, they're in a bad way, uvecherpa, in disgrace or in anger, vechomad Yerushalayim miforatzet, the wall of Yerushalayim had been breached, usharan it's tuvaish, and the gates had been burnt with fire. Okay, do we have any questions about these psukim? Anything we're confused about or want to know about? Well, I'll start with one, which is, when did Yerushalayim get attacked? Right? If you read Sefer Ezra, I don't think we have a record of any war being waged against Yerushalayim, such that the city had been breached. That's very unusual. It's a very odd reference. The timeline's strange. What's strange about the timeline?
When is this? What's happening? What's, I mean, just like you were saying, it's a little jumbled.
Right. In rabbinic idiom, we'd call the Iker Chasar Min HaSefer. Like, there's important information here that's been omitted. Right, we don't know what the historical context is here, and we don't get more in the next couple of verses. It's not like we're about to, you know, find out and cut this at a convenient place to build tension. Right, it's not clear what historical event is being referred to here.
Is there anything
in Divrei Hayamim? So Divrei Hayamim ends at the very beginning of Sefer Ezra. Right, the last two verses of Divrei Hayamim are basically the first verses of Ezra. So actually, there's nothing there that's going to be kind of reflective of that.
Is this before Esther, after Esther? Because he mentioned Shushan.
Right. So the chronology that we're working with places Nehemiah definitely, or I think everyone places Nehemiah after the Esther story, so we really shouldn't say. But why Shushan Habira? So as long as the Persians are in control, so Shushan is, you know, the capital, one of the capitals of the Persian Empire. So there's one of the major cities that they would be living in. Yeah, right. So they had, that was earlier when they were trying to find the records of Koresh allowing us to return. Right, so there was another city there. I could try to dig up the name. I think it was in Ezra Parak Vav or something like that, where they had a summer palace for the king and a winter palace. And that would, those would differ a little bit. Let's see, was it the beginning of Parak Vav? Achmata, right. Achmata Bibirta. Birta, like Bira, Shushan HaBira was one capital, or one fortress, and then the other fortress in Achmata, well, that was another location where the Persian royal family spent their time. So Shushan is one of them. Yeah. Okay, good. So that's one question. We'll get to that in a little bit. Just one other note, and we talked about this already, we alluded to this in terms of the authorship of this part of the book. So the Metzudah David, and I think the standard reading of this pasuk would say, Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia, would mean that Nehemiah ben Chachalia wrote the following words. And you go through the Sefer and you see, at least for the next several prakim, it's very clear this is all from the mouth of the character Nehemiah, the person Nehemiah. And we saw the Gemara in Sanhedrin that also sounded like Nehemiah wrote it, and it's just called Ezra because Nehemiah wasn't as good a guy as we would want. Some try to say for Tanakh. It's not entirely clear because the Gemara in Bava Batra sounds otherwise. The Gemara sounds like Ezra actually wrote his book, which is the book of Ezra, which includes these prakim. So it's not 100% clear whether, this is Ezra writing about Nehemiah or kind of incorporating stuff that Nehemiah said into his Sefer, whether Nehemiah really wrote this piece. It's a little bit trickier to kind of pin down some of these details. The more, you know, interesting point, as we alluded to already, is that Nehemiah doesn't get so much background, right? Ezra, we learned about the generations all the way back to Aaron. We learned about his tremendous yichus. Ezra cares a lot about that. Nehemiah, we don't have that much of that. Rabbi Sinensky notes this. None of the trappings we saw in the case of Ezra are present for Nehemiah. Only one generation of the latter's lineage is outlined, not 17. Whereas Ezra was introduced as an accomplished scholar, he was a sofer mahir, we saw, in the Perek Zion of Ezra, who had diligently prepared himself. Nehemiah arrives on the scene with little fanfare. Now, that's not entirely true. We'll get, at the end of the parak, to a little bit more about Nehemiah in terms of his qualifications and his background and how significant he is in the Persian court. But at the beginning, we just jump in. Nehemiah ben Chachalia, who? And that itself is kind of interesting. Rabbi Sinensky has a couple of theories about this. Possibly, it's merely a function of the respective literary characters of each work. Nehemiah is in first-person narrative, and so is perhaps appropriately hesitant to shower himself with appellations. Meaning, Nehemiah could have started by telling you about how great he is. He could have started by saying, we'll find out later in the parak, that he's, you know, a high advisor in the Persian court, and he has a personal relationship with Artaxasta, the king, and you really could have started with that. Right? Divrei Nehemiah ben Chachalia, Asher Haya, Be'atzat HaMelech, or something like that. He doesn't do that. So it could be a kind of humility. In that case, it's worth contrasting Nehemiah's early humility with his later self-promotion. As we'll explore later in our series, on numerous occasions, Nehemiah asks God for recognition of his achievements. The rabbis viewed this as arrogant, and they criticized Nehemiah. So it could be that Nehemiah starts off being much more modest, and he becomes a little bit more arrogant over time. Right? The alleged sins of Nehemiah we saw in the Gemara appear in Parak Hay already. Right? They quote verses from there, not from the beginning of the book. That's a possibility. It also could just be that Nehemiah didn't have any yichus that was worth talking about. And Ezra, well, he goes back to Aaron HaKohen. That's a really big deal. Nehemiah, he's not anybody special. He's the son of Chachalia. We don't know anything about Chachalia. And so maybe he's not so sort of significant by virtue of his yichus, and maybe more so by virtue of what he goes on to do. And that might be another distinction between Ezra and Nehemiah in terms of, you know, where they're coming to this job from their lineage and their heritage, or no, they just do the job as well as they can. So that's Nehemiah. We find out he's in Shushan, and then one of his brothers, Hanani, comes and he asks them, okay, so what's going on with the Jews in Yehuda right now? Who is Hanani? We're told that he's one of his brothers. So, do they have the same parents? It could be, right? Brothers is a word that very likely, you know, is a kind of idiom. It means one of his friends, someone he's close to, has a relationship with. Rashi says, Echad mechaverai. You know, brother in the colloquial sense. We're all brothers and sisters. You know, or in the national sense. You know, we're all part of the same, you know, extended family. The Dot Mikra commentary actually takes the idea seriously that maybe they're literal brothers. That Hanani is, you know, part of Ezra's Nehemiah's family. He's living in Yerushalayim. Nehemiah is not. Maybe even Nehemiah had, you know, moved. The whole family had made Aliyah, and then Nehemiah had kind of gone back to Persia at some point for some reason. That's a possibility that they raise in the commentary there, and they infer from a pasuk in the next parak of Nehemiah, which we'll get to whenever we get to the next parak, that it could even be that Nehemiah's parents were buried in Yerushalayim. Which means that maybe the whole family was there, and Nehemiah was the straggler who had stayed back in Persia or who had returned to Persia for some reason. And we have to figure out why that would be if that happened. There's a third possibility, right? So one, it could be that brother means brother literally. Another is that it's just an idiom. It means one of his friends. Josephus, in his description of the story, now you have to figure out, is Josephus like a biblical commentary, right? We think of him as a historian, but the parts of Josephus where he's quoting stories from Tanakh, presumably Tanakh is one of, if not the only source for these stories. So it's unclear whether he's like reading the story and interpreting it, or whether he's just kind of telling it as a historian would and glossing over some details and not being as precise as you might like. So when Josephus tells the story, he talks about him as a stranger, right? Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king, and he ran into some strangers who were speaking Hebrew, and he asked them, oh, you must be from Judea, because they're speaking Hebrew. What's going on in Judea? So that's kind of interesting that he glosses over Echad Me'achai. So it could be that he is, you know, not speaking precisely for whatever reason. It could also be that Echad Me'achai just means one of my you know, a member of my nation. Va'avta l'reicha kamocha. Not necessarily a personal friend, just you're a member of my people. We're all brothers in some deeper sense. And so when you hear someone speaking your language, you're really happy. Wow, he speaks Hebrew. Obviously, he's one of us. And you can ask him a question. And it's not like a planned meeting or a rendezvous. It's just a happenstance. You ran into one another. So I think it's plausible that Josephus is just trying to interpret the story. Achad me'achai just means one of the members of my nation. It's not always clear whether achai is used in that context, but you have that. For example, in the laws of slavery in the end of Vayikra, you have v'chi amuch achicha, right? Any mitzvah that applies to your brother. It doesn't mean your brother. It doesn't mean to someone you like, per se. It means to a Jew. So it could be that the term is being used in the same way here as well. So he asks this question, what's going on with the Jews? And he says, and he finds out, things are really terrible. So why are things really terrible, or what happened? So one possibility, says the Metzudat David and several other commentaries, is that this is just referring to the state of the Jewish people in Yerushalayim. Meaning to say, just to get more specific, is that the people who he's referring to are not the Jews who had already been in Israel at the time. They're the small number of Jews, let's say the tens of thousands who had went up from exile and had returned to Yerushalayim. Why does it mean? It says the Jews who remained, Nisha'aru is the term the Pasuk uses, but he says they're the remainder, right? The main Jewish population is still in exile, they're still in Bavel, but there's a small population who went up to Yerushalayim, they're called the She'erit HaPleita, right? The remaining group. But they're not really the main members of the Jewish people. Malbim wants to say it differently. Malbim says in source number 16 that actually it's the Jews who had gone up from Yerushalayim who were sort of a protected class of Jews, right? They're there by royal decree. Koresh allows them to return. They're under special protection. But there were also plenty of Jews. We've mentioned this several times already. There were plenty of Jews who had not actually gone out to exile. And they'd been living in Israel in various provinces, maybe even around Yerushalayim. But they were not under special royal protection. And so they were in a really sorry state. That's what it means, the She'erit. They're literally the ones who had remained and who had not gone out to exile in the first place. And so the mainstream view is going to say these are the people who had gone back, but things were not going well for them. Malbim wants to say, no, it's even the Jews who had remained there, specifically the Jews who had remained there. That's why it means the She'erit, those who remained, because they never gone out to exile in the first place. But either way, things are bad. The question is what population it's bad for. Now, why are things bad? And that was the most obvious, glaring question from reading the Pesukim. And there was also not entirely clear. So some of the commentaries, like Ralbag, for example, in source number 17, wants to say things are just bad because they've been bad the whole time, basically. Right? We read Ezra, and we kind of felt Ezra ended on somewhat of a triumphant note. The Beit HaMikdash is rebuilt, Jews are returning, we're ending intermarriage, things are going okay. Ralbag says, no, things are really not going so okay. And the evidence is quite interesting. Ralbag says, when it says the city was destroyed, the walls were breached, the gates were burned, that's a reference to the Churban, which, right, by the traditional chronology, had happened, let's say, 70, 80 years ago. By the chronology that we're using in the Sefer, it happened over 100 years ago. And yet, that's the reference here in the Pasuk. Now, why does he have to say that? Ki lo banu adayin choma le'ir Yerushalayim. Right, you might remember back from already Prakim Gimel Dalid, figuring out what exactly we had permission to do from Koresh, from Daryavesh. A simple way of reading those Pesukim was to say that we did not have permission to build the walls. We only had permission to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash itself. So how could it be that the walls of the city were destroyed when we had not rebuilt the walls yet from the Churban in the first place? Right? When you build walls, that's a really strong statement. Right? You're letting the people within those walls be autonomous from the Persians. Maybe the Persians want to exert their authority and prevent rebellion, so they don't let you rebuild the walls. So it makes sense that we hadn't yet gotten permission to rebuild the walls, and this is just a reference to the Churban had happened. Things were still not really, not very good at all at this point. They only had permission to build the Beit HaMikdash, so that's great, but they're still very vulnerable. Maybe there had even been like a local attack on a smaller level because we didn't have the protection that we needed by having walls. And we'll see that Nehemiah eventually gets involved and does facilitate building walls. But the city was in kind of a sorry state at the get-go, and they'd only had a smaller And whatever happened was on the smaller scale. It could also be that there's a reference here to an event that we don't have recorded in Sefer Ezra Nehemiah. It's not in our history books. Maybe it's not so relevant. Maybe we just didn't have any good authoritative records of what happened. But there was some incursion, some attack that had happened at this time. The Dat Mikra says, the Shivi Zeh lo yadanu milakacha. We don't know who took captivity here, but there was some kind of raid, some kind of attack on the city that had left the people who had been living there in a really bad place. Again, we don't know what happened, but at some point, let's see, between the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, perhaps, there had been some kind of attack that weakened the Jewish population in Yerushalayim. And that, of course, suggests it was either in the days of Achashverosh or in the days of Artaxasta, but in some recent period in history that this had happened. Right, so an unknown attack, not the Khorban, right? We're not just in a sorry state because it had already happened, you know, decades ago. But even right now, there were still events that were happening because of the vulnerability of being in a city without walls. It could even be that we had tried to start building walls and they were shaken down again. Maybe that's referred to back in Perek Dalet, where that was where the chronological issues got most complicated. But regardless, so we have these two possibilities. Right? One, this is just a reflection of the fact that things had never really gotten very good. Things kind of remained bad the whole time since the Khorban. And even when we'd come back, things were still bad in a material state. Yeah, like the best thing that happened was we built the Beit HaMikdash, but still we were not so great. Or even we'd been attacked since then, and we have more opposition from the outside than it appeared initially from our earlier Sfarim. Regardless, this is really bad news. And Nehemiah takes the news very personally, and he starts davening, and will eventually come to try to fix the problem. But at the very least, he's davening at this point. Vayhi cheshom iya tzedvarim ha'ela, yashavti in Pesach Dalet, in source number 19. Vayvke, so I heard these things, so I sat down, and I cried, ve'etabla yamim, and I mourned for several days. Vayhitzam, and I was fasting, umitpalel lefnei alukei ha'shamayim. I was fasting, and I was davening to the God of heaven. Let's do this. Let's read the psukim, and then we'll kind of parse and add some commentary over the course of the story as a whole. So here's his tefillah. First he's fasting, he's mourning. Then he starts davening. Va'omar, Ana Hashem, please Hashem, Elokei Hashemayim, God of heaven, Hakel Hagadol Vahanora. That's very familiar. It's Mona Esrei, Hakel Hagadol Hagibor Vahanora. Shomer Habrit Vahachesed, Lo'avav Ulushomrei Mitzvotav. You know, you might start noticing that's another familiar phrase. You'll start noticing other familiar phrases if you're paying attention, right? Familiar from Tanakh, familiar from davening, mm-hmm. Not coincidentally.
Yom Kippur davening.
Certainly a lot of this comes back up, right, in Yom Kippur. There's a lot of Tachanun-like language that's going to be relevant here. Tehina aznacha koshevet, may your ear be attuned, ve'enacha p'duchot, and your eyes open, l'shmo al tefillat abdacha, to hear my prayer. He's almost asking permission to daven. You know, please accept my tefillah. Asher Elohim mepalel lefanecha that I'm davening to you. Hayom, today, yomam v'layla, day and night. Al b'nei Yisrael avdecha, on b'nei Yisrael, your servants. Umitvadeh, and the confession that I'm doing. Al chatot b'nei Yisrael, and the sins of the Jewish people. Asher chatanu lach, ani uveit avi chatanu. That we sin to you, me, my family, my father's house. Again, that reflection of, we saw in Ezra earlier as well, you know, kind of taking responsibility, even if you're not necessarily the ones who are sinning. Also, right, very reminiscent of Yom Kippur. Ashamnu, bagadnu, the sins that we did, not necessarily the sins that I did, but we collectively take on certain kinds of responsibility. Chavol chavalnu lach. Very difficult phrase to translate, so we'll come back to that. Sounds like it means that we have wounded God. Chavala is a wound, but it's hard to wound God. I've never been successful. I haven't tried, but I imagine I would not be so successful if I tried. But we also, and maybe this is how we hurt God, lo shamarnu et ha-mitzvot, we haven't done the mitzvot, v'adachukim et mishpatim asher tzivita et Moshe avdecha, we haven't done the mitzvot that we've been commanded to do. So there's confession, here's what we did wrong. Zechor nata davar asher tzivita et Moshe avdecha le'mor, atem timalu ani afis etchem ba'amim. So you remember the deal that we had. The deal was that if you break the rules, im tim'al, if you betray, then I, Hashem, will scatter you among the people, v'shavtem elai, but you could return to me, ushmartem mitzvotai vasitem otam, and if you do the mitzvot, then im yeridachem yiktei ha-shamayim, misham akabtzeim, v'aviotim ala makom asher bachartik l'shakinet shmisham. Then I will bring you back, and you will come to dwell in the place that I have caused my name to dwell as well. right? Vavi yotim al harkachi. Obviously, we're being reminded of imi chacham yisei shemayim mishami kebetzcha Hashem alokachu mishami kachacha. A lot of familiar language. We'll talk about where it's familiar from. Why should you do this for your people? Because these are your servants, A, meaning we fundamentally are committed to you, and we're the nation that you freed from Mitzrayim. Right? We're that same nation. Right? A little bit reminiscent of Moshe's tefillah, right? Lama yomru Mitzrayim lemor. Right? This is the nation that you that we have a relationship with you. So you should remember us and redeem us from whatever this tzara is. Right? Now, this is really interesting because we don't know that much about the tzara. We don't know what happened. Again, maybe it's just the generic galus, but that's been going on for a long time already. Maybe it's some kind of new incursion. We don't know that much about it, but we know about the response to it. We know about how Nehemiah is trying to deal with it in his tefila. Ana Hashem, Hashem, please, tina aznacha kashevet al tefilat avdecha val tefilat avdecha. May your ear be attuned to the prayer of your servant, me, and your other servants, who want to have yira for you, want to fear and revere you. And let your servant be prosperous today. And may he find mercy in the eyes of this person. We don't know who this person is, but by context, it seems like it's probably the king. Right, I'm about to go into the king, right? If you want to think about Esther parallels here, right? Esther also goes in front of the king, but before she goes in front of the king, the Midrashim say, she davens, she arranges also for 3 days of fasting and tila. Very resonant. This is a man in Shushan. Certainly not a coincidence. And now we're going to get the context that kind of leads us into the next story. Vani hayiti mashkelen alach. I was the cupbearer of the king, so I'm about to go in and cupbearer for the king, but let me first have Hashem's help before I do so. Right? So there's a vidui element, acknowledging fault. There's the request, listen to us, bring us back from exile, save us from whatever's happening in Yerushalayim at this point. And the particular request, I'm about to go into the king, may be successful. So there are a lot of interesting things happening in this tefila. In the time that we have, we probably cannot do all of them. But let's see, should we at least try to start? You know what, I think we'll try to finish the parak today. It'll be a few minutes longer than normal, but we'll try to, you know, get this tefillah, and then we'll be able to continue with his conversation with the melech. So, a couple of notes. First note, and, you know, we're going to be constantly kind of in this back and forth between comparisons to Ezra and contrasts, right? So those comparisons, he's davening. That already is quite significant, right? Don't think he's just a political leader. He's also a religious figure. He fasts and cries and mourns and davens just like Ezra does. But it's not exactly the same. So a couple of differences that Rabbi Sanansky notes. Number one, Ezra referred to God as God of my forefathers, the Jewish God. Nehemiah, he's in the Persian court. He's using almost the Persian way to refer to God, right? Koresh calls Hashem Elokei HaShemayim, the God of the heavens. Nehemiah does too. Not God of my forefathers, God of Abraham, God of Yitzhak, God of Yaakov. God of the heavens. Again, reflecting a little bit his role, maybe in his place in the Persian court, he's going to use the terminology that's most appropriate there. Also, and we didn't note this, but we'll see this more more fully as we go, that Nehemiah seems to use the secular dating system that counts months from Tishrei and not months from Adar, or from Nisan rather, not Adar. Gave a shiur on Adar Rishon, Adar Sheni last night rather, so very very on my mind. But so we'll see that Nehemiah might be using this dating system. We'll see that in the beginning of the next parak, where, you know, this is happening in Kislev, he finds out this news. And then in Nisan, of that same year, he's going to go in front of the king. How is that of the same year? Nisan's the beginning of the new year. Well, obviously, he's counting from Tishrei, right? So that's interesting also, that he's, again, borrowing a little bit of the language and a little bit of the chronologies of the Persian society. That's point number one. That's quite interesting. Reflecting, again, his place in the court. Number two, we saw the phrase Hakel Hagibur Vahanora. I'm sorry, Hagadol Vahanora. So that's interesting. That's a phrase that starts out being a phrase that Moshe uses, but is modified slightly. And this is a kind of common Gemara and Yoma. It's good to see it in this context, where the Gemara notes that Moshe used the phrase Hakel Hagadol Hagibur Vahanora, And we'll talk about the parallels that he draws on from Moshe's tefillah and from other tefillahs. But can you really call Hashem great, mighty, awesome when the Jews are in Galus and they're being attacked in the land and the city of Yerushalayim is in ruins? So the Gemara there says that Daniel says, Goyim ishtabdim b'banav, your children are in exile. Aye gurotav, where is God's might? And therefore Daniel did not use the word Gibor, and Nehemiah, whose tefillah paralleled Daniel's tefillah very closely, also doesn't use the word Gibor. Again, reflecting the state of the Jewish people at the time, this is not the tefillah of strength. Right? We're all so strong, we're in your land, we're following the mitzvah. No, we can't say the word Gibor in this context. The Gemara goes on to explain that the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah did try to defend using the word Gibor because God's might is not only in physical might of his people, but in other places. But just noting, you know, the kind of parallel to Moshe and the contrast, where Moshe is dealing with a much stronger position of the Jewish people. They're on the border of the Yarden. They're about to enter the land. It's a high point in Jewish history. Nehemiah's dealing with a bit of a low point. That's another kind of interesting piece. A third interesting observation about the tefillah, we're going to kind of learn broader principles of tefillah today as well, is that Nehemiah follows in a long tradition of almost asking for permission to daven, right? So he doesn't quite ask for permission, but he asks for Hashem to pay attention before he starts actually davening, right? You could start davening just by saying, Hashem, I need you to do this, or that, or the other thing. But he doesn't. The first thing he says is, jumping back to the beginning of the tefillah in Pasuk Dalid, Pasuk Hey. So first of all, you know, Baruch Hashem Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu defines who Hashem is, and then, Tina Azalacha Koshevet v'Einacha P'tuchot Lishmo El Tefillat Avdecha. Sometimes Hashem's going to listen, sometimes not. So you're asking that Hashem's going to listen to you. Avram does the same thing in verse number 22. You know, I even though I'm nothing, I'm pleased, you know, listen to my tefillah. And we do it every time we daven too. We almost ask for Hashem to let our tefillah be successful. Hashem sfatai tiftachu fi agiti latecha. Right? We're setting ourselves up for success in davening before we actually start doing that. There's a lot of religious meaning to that phenomenon. We'll talk about it more fully in just a minute. But it's an interesting thing to know that, you know, he's following a little bit of precedent in the style of the tefillah. And, you know, we think of davening, or it's easy to think of davening as you go up to Hashem and you say whatever you want, whatever you're feeling, whatever you're thinking. Nehemiah says it's not so simple to say whatever you're thinking and feeling. But you ask Hashem to be in the right mood to listen to you. You also put yourself in the right mindset to be going to Hashem. Right? You don't think that you're so great. You know that Hashem needs to do you an extra favor even just to listen to what you have to say. And that puts you in a good mindset for a successful tefillah before you start making requests or demands. No, realize that Hashem might even need a little encouragement even just to listen properly. And, you know, it's not always so obvious that Hashem is in the right mood to listen. There are other places where it seems like Hashem will say, no, I don't want to hear your tefillahs right now. I'm not interested. So here, you know, that's a major like Tisha B'Av theme, let's say. Satam Tfilati is the Megillah and Eicha, right? On Tisha B'Av, we cut down on davening. It's not a day of davening. Hashem's not listening to us anyway. On Tisha B'Av, that's not the theme of the day. Now, speaking of this idea of precedent, right, we also see a notion that it could be that a lot of this Tila is kind of borrowed on familiar phrases from Moshe's Tfilot in Sefer Devarim. And Shlomo, the Dat Mikra notes this in verse number 24, a lot of the language here is borrowed from either Shlomo's prayer when he inaugurates the Beit HaMikdash, or Moshe in Sefer Devarim. And that's really interesting, right, why he's borrowing this language. Well, we already noted a couple of examples, but Shomer HaBrit HaVeChesed Lo'Avav L'Shomrei Mitzvotav, that's a Devarim phrase. The Dat Mikra is pretty thorough in terms of identifying where all the language is coming from. Right. So that's a Devarim line. Hakel Agadol V'Hanora we saw. V'Einecha P'tuchot, Aliot Einecha P'tuchot Al HaBayit HaZeh is a language from Malachim by Shlomo. He quotes the language of in Pasuk Tet, Vishavtem, Elai Ushmortem Mitzvotai V'Asitem Otam, Im Yenedach HaKab Yitzei HaShemayim, Yisham HaKab Tzeim. That's a very common Devarim language. So we're borrowing a lot of this language here. And so, again, we want to figure out why he's doing that, right? Just as a contrast, right? David HaMelech writes lots of tefillot that borrow language, but not in such obvious ways. And sometimes David is writing tefillot and Tehillim that don't have precedent or parallel in a direct, obvious way to phrases that we see in Chumash. So why is Nehemiah interested in doing this? Why is he borrowing this language in his tefillot? He could just say his tefillah in his own words. So there's a lot of thought we could say here, just to note a couple of possibilities. Could be that he is looking to further buttress his religious bona fides, right? He's there as a political leader, but he also wants to show he's a serious religious person. So if you make a tefillah in following a biblical precedent, that shows I'm also a serious religious person, right? I'm not just a political, askan, but I'm someone who knows how to do the religious thing too. Let me show that I know the language of Chumash, obviously, and that I'm following in the model of these great religious leaders. That's possible on the one hand. Could be that he is trying not to show himself as a religious leader like David and Moshe and Shlomo, but more of a political leader. Right? Moshe is a melech. He is Gedula, we saw in the Gemara earlier. He's leading the Jewish people into the land of Israel. Shlomo is leading the Jewish people into having a Beit HaMikdash. The Bayit Rishon period begins with Shlomo. He's also the Melech. And so Nehemiah, as a political leader, is also kind of announcing himself at this point, borrowing the language of other political leaders who are Malachim, who are kings. So too, he also is going to be a political kind of leader. A third possibility, maybe, is that if you want to make sure your tefillah is going to be really good, so you want to borrow on the language of other tefillah that we know is really good, right? If you start davening in your own language, who knows how well that's going to work out for you. But if you daven like Moshe Rabbeinu davens, you're in at least as good a place as you can be, right? Now, it's not a magical formula. You don't just say the words and everything works out well. But if you want to invoke some precedent in terms of how good your tefillah could be, so certainly that's a way to get there. So borrow language of other successful tefillah from great religious leaders. You just want your tefillah to work well. So you might want to do that. So that's a third possibility, right, to burnish his religious qualifications, his political qualifications as a melech, or to have the tefillah that might be most successful, and using the language of tefillah that has worked from great leaders as well. A fourth possibility, and this is a broader thesis in the world of tefillah as a whole, but you'll notice that we in our davening use biblical language all the time, right? So much of Chumash, so much of our Siddur is borrowed from Tanakh. Now that's true in obvious places, like Psukei Dezimra, where it's just Psukim, right? From Tehillim mostly, but to other Sfarim as well, Az Yashir. But even in the language of Brachot, right? Most Brachot are a language that we know from places in Chumash, from places in Tehillim, Malbish Arumim, Zokeith Kfufim, Hamos Yelachem Min Ha'aretz is biblical, it appears in Tehillim. Refe'inu Hashem V'nei Rafeihu She'inu V'nei Vashaya, that's modified very slightly from Yeshayahu, I want to say. Right, so you could go through the Siddur and have a Tanakh with you and just draw all the parallels, and it would be obscene. In a good way, just so rich in those parallels. It's not a bug, it's a feature. It's how we want our tefillah to look. Rav Soloveitchik gives a religious meaning to this. I found just one formulation of it, but it's a common motif in the Rav's thought that tefillah is not something that we just get to do whenever we want. The fact that we could go up to God and have the audacity to ask for something, and first of all, the audacity to even just show up and start talking to Hashem, and then the audacity to ask Hashem for things, that's incredibly bold. And so Rav Soloveitchik has this motif that appears in many, many places in his thinking about tefillah as, or parts of tefillah as what we call a matir, that they give you permission to approach God. So for example, we say, Hashem Shvatai Titachu V'yegiti Latecha, that's our way of asking permission to then go to Hashem in davening. Psukei Dezimra is a way of asking for permission before we get to the more essential, central parts of davening and make the request that we're going to make. Lots of davening has this feature of being a matir, where we need permission to do certain religious kinds of things. And one way to get permission to daven is to borrow language from other people who were Nevi'im, and they knew for sure the right things that you're allowed to say to Hashem and not. So if you're not so confident in your own formulations, and you want to know that you're saying something that's okay to say to Hashem, so the Nevi'im are the way to do that. How can we say Rasal Avichim in Source 26? Which prayer is appropriate and which prayer inadequate? It's one of the great mysteries in the history of the God-man relationship. We have no idea what's okay to say to Hashem and what's an absurd blasphemy to say to Hashem. Hence, we must not rely too much on our own talent and ingenuity in composing prayers and petitions. We are ignorant as to what pleases God and what is sheer impudence. Therefore, our sages were careful with regard to the composition and formulation of new prayers, and when they did so, they borrowed formulations from Psukim. And so, Nehemiah is very much following in exactly that legacy. You have no idea what prayers are good when you're allowed to even pray in the first place, and so you borrow on precedent from people who you know were in a position to pray properly, the Nevi'im and the great leaders of previous generations. Just like two more very quick notes in terms of the end of the prayer and the end of the parak, and then we'll conclude for the week. Number one is this phrase, chavol chavalnu lach, you've wounded God. Right, so if you're, you know, a certain kind of mystical thinker and you think that, you know, the mitzvot that we do and the actions that we do in this world have an impact on the celestial realms, right? That's an idea that exists in the world of, you know, Kabbalistic thinking. So then maybe it's a little bit easier to stomach. But, you know, the rationalist Jewish tradition certainly doesn't think this is plausible. And the Rabbag says so. You should know that a person cannot harm God with their sins. Chavol chaval doesn't make any sense. You're not wounding God. It just means that you're doing something bad that is related to God. Right? So when you say you are corrupting your ways, chavala could mean corruption, and that's the way most commentaries want to translate it. We're not hurting God at all. We are corrupting our ways vis-a-vis God. God is sort of like the context. So in religious ways, we're being corrupt relative to God. So, for example, we're serving Avodah Zarah. That's a corruption that relates to God. But it's not corrupting God. God obviously isn't changing by virtue of the fact that I'm going to be doing this. The Malbim has a different idea. He says chavol doesn't mean corruption. It really means taking the collateral. You have that phrase in a couple of the legal passages in Chumash, the halachic sections. And so it means that, you know, we made a deal with you, so to speak. You know, we'll serve you. In exchange, we get your land, we get the Beit HaMikdash. When we stop serving you, you take those back. And then when we start serving you again, we get them back. That's how collaterals work. Until you pay off the debt, you lose the collateral. But once you pay off the debt, you can get it back. And so that very much flows nicely into the next couple of psukim, where he says, we made a deal that if we do wrong, we'll get sent away. But if we do tshuva, we'll be able to come back. So, you know, feeds very nicely into the rest of the section. Another interesting detail about the tefillah. And finally, one concluding note. We talked about Nehemiah as the cupbearer of the king. What does a cupbearer of a king do? Right. So we get the sense, and we have other cupbearers in Jewish tradition, right? The Sar HaMashkim by Yosef. Seems like he's not a nobody. He's not just a regular old cook in the kitchen. Seems like he's a sar. He's something of an officer. Daniel serves as a cupbearer. I think Rabbi Sensky quotes a couple of others in. Let's find it. Too many. Those things, too much Torah, but. Okay, so he doesn't quote any other examples. There may be other examples also of cupbearers in the king's palace. So, what does a cupbearer do? So, one possibility, is, Rashi says, is that the cupbearer is the one who, you know, shows up. You know, and delivers to the king. Right? So the kitchen will produce all the food, but the cupbearer is the one who serves before the king. And that's, you know, you're in a direct, immediate context where you get to interact with the king, and not necessarily the highest stature that you can have, but at the very least you have personal connection to the king. And that's relevant because Nehemiah is going to have a conversation with him in the next parak. So that's one possibility. Another, this is really interesting, is that maybe the cupbearer had the job of tasting the wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. So that doesn't make it sound like you're so chashev. If you were really a significant person, I wouldn't want you to be poisoned either. You really want some grunts to be poisoned. So, you know, you're basically a glorified guard, right? You taste the wine and make sure it's not going to be poisoned. That doesn't sound like it's such a high role, right? And that fits again with this picture of Nehemiah maybe being a little bit more modest, at least at this stage in the Sefer. But another possibility, and this is one that the academic community takes very seriously, is that actually a cupbearer is a pretty serious role that you can have. Right, so Dov Zakhan has that claim here in Source 31. The cupbearer to the Persian emperor was an extremely powerful courtier. So maybe you also serve the king wine, but you're also in the inner circle, you know, among his greatest advisors, like the biblical Joseph, and for that matter, the Persian cupbearer Achikar, who the apocryphal book the author of the apocryphal book of Tobit describes as a keeper of the royal seal, calculator of the accounts. Nehemiah was virtually a second in command to the emperor. So when he's saying Nehemiah is just a mashkel ha-melech, I don't think that means that he's just serving drinks. Nehemiah actually, and even at this early stage in the book, is a pretty significant member of the court. Right? Turns out serving wine to the king shows how significant you are. Right? You know, just a small mashal, right? You have this idea in Jewish circles of a shamish, where you have, you know, a great gadol, and then you have someone whose job it is to accompany them. Now, is driving around someone a particularly prestigious role? Not necessarily. But you're someone's constant companion, and you get to learn from them and have experience with them and have a relationship with them. So it could be that this is, you know, kind of exactly a model for that. You know, you're doing a, you know, maybe a somewhat menial service, but you might also be doing many other services, as Zakheim and others suggest. And even if not, you're still in the king's inner circle and you're in a position to make the kind of request that Nehemiah is going to in our next parak. Okay, Adkan Nehemiah parak Aleph.